This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Exodus. Today, Pastor Sandy will teach through Exodus, chapters 15 through 18. Let's join him now.
Exodus chapter 15, God's parting of the Red Sea, his mighty victory over the Pharaoh and the Egyptians, inspired Moses to compose a fight song for Israel to sing. As a matter of fact, this is the first song or the first psalm in all of the Bible. Apparently, Moses was not only a great deliverer, he was also a great composer. And tonight we'll study Moses' lyrics. Sadly, he's no longer with us to play the tune. You all know that Moses is dead. I guess you could say he's now decomposing. But verse 1 tells us, "Then Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord and spoke, saying, 'I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and the rider he has thrown into the sea.'" In other words, God never ekes out a victory. Did you know God never wins at the buzzer? All his victories are by the slaughter rule. He always skunks his opponents. God leads the league in blowouts. As Moses put it, he has triumphed gloriously. "The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord," catch this, "is a man of war. The Lord, Jehovah, is his name." Notice God is no pacifist. He is a man of war. God is not squeamish in the heat of battle. He certainly doesn't faint at the sight of blood. You know, some wars are just. There's a need to put down evil and uphold righteousness. Some wars have to be fought. God, we're told, is a man of war. "Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea. His chosen captains also are drowned in the Red Sea. The depths have covered them. They sank to the bottom like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, has become glorious in power. Your right hand, O Lord, has dashed the enemy in pieces." How many right-handed people here tonight? Okay, how many left-handed people here tonight? Well, you know, if you figured this out, it would probably hold to the rule, and that's that 90% of the people are right-handed, only about 10% of the people are left-handed. And the idea here that Moses is communicating is that God took a strong right-handed approach against his enemy. In other words, he acted bluntly and boldly and forcibly. You see, the Bible teaches that God is a spirit. He is spirit. It's doubtful, really, that he has human-like features like hands and feet and eyes and ears. And yet, throughout the scripture, God ascribes to himself human traits. How else can we finite, fleshly human beings really relate to an infinite God unless he speaks to us in terms that we can understand? And so there are times when he talks about the eyes of the Lord. There are times when he talks about God's ears are open to our cries. At other times that he works with a strong right hand. Whenever God speaks of himself in human terms, we call it by a fancy term, an anthropomorphism. That just means that God is trying to relate to us in terms that we can understand. Verse 7 tells us, "And in the greatness of your excellence, you have overthrown those who rose against you. You sent forth your wrath. It consumed them like stubble. And with the blast of your nostrils, the waters were gathered together. The flood stood upright like a heap. The depths congealed in the heat of the sea, in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, 'I will pursue, I will overtake, I will devour the spoil. My desire shall be satisfied on them. I will draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them.' But you blew with your wind, the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters." A wind from God had parted the Red Sea for the Hebrews to cross. Then that same wind blew again and drowned the Egyptians. A strong east wind had did God's bidding. Verse 11, "Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? You stretched out your right hand." Again, it's because God's hand is a strong hand. That's why he calls it a right hand. The earth swallowed them. You in your mercy have led forth the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them in your strength to your holy habitation. Notice God never just brings us out. He brings us out to bring us into something better. He brought them out of bondage into his holy habitation. And you know, God will never bring you out of something unless he's planning on bringing you into something better. Verse 14, the people will hear and be afraid. Sorrow will take hold of the inhabitants of Philistia. When the chiefs of Edom will be dismayed, the mighty men of Moab trembling will take hold of them. All the inhabitants of Canaan will melt away. In other words, God's victory over the Egyptians will strike fear in the hearts of the surrounding nations. He says, fear and dread will fall on them. By the greatness of your arm, they will be as still as a stone till your people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over whom you have purchased. Now, though in the ancient world there was no internet or television news, it still didn't take long for the word to get around. Caravans and travelers would bring news from distant lands as to what was going on around the world. And these nations, who might have been tempted to oppose Israel, they would know better, because the news would have reached them of how God, the God of Israel, had vanquished the mighty Egyptians. He says, you will bring them in and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance. In other words, in the land of Canaan. In the place, O Lord, which you have made for your own dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. Verse 18 is emphatic. For the Lord shall reign forever and ever. And here he offers proof of his ability to do so. For the horses of Pharaoh went with his chariots and his horsemen into the sea. And the Lord brought back the waters of the sea upon them. But the children of Israel went on dry land in the midst of the sea. Any God who could do that can certainly reign forever and ever. Now, after Moses writes this song, his sister Miriam picks up a tambourine. And she choreographs a dance. We don't know what the tune that Moses wrote sounded like. And we don't know what this dance looked like. But she organized some women to sing and play and dance to her brother's tune. You remember, Miriam was Moses' older sister who had come to the Pharaoh's daughter after she had discovered Moses in the bulrushes and had arranged for Moses' mother to actually nurse him until he came of age. Here she leads the Hebrews in their celebration. Then Miriam, the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dances. And Miriam answered them, sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. And if God has triumphed gloriously in your life, I hope you sing to him a song of praise. Verse 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Now remember, finding water for 2 to 3 million people in the desert was no small task. And after 3 days out in the wilderness without water, the people are beginning to starve. I mean, they're beginning to thirst. They're feeling very uncomfortable. This was a desperate situation, really. They're on the verge of dehydration. On the heels of victory, they're challenged again. Now, when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Marah means bitter. Apparently, this stream that they came to was polluted. Maybe it contained a heavy mineral content. We're not sure. But what a disappointment. They finally come to water, and it's like the Yellow River. It's got foam on the top of it. It stinks. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. And the people complained against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Now, chapter 15 is really a strange chapter, in my opinion. It starts out with a celebration of God's mighty power, but it ends up with the people whining about no water. God just parted an ocean. Don't you think he can provide you a little drinking water? Come on. Why start grumbling already? It's been said some people like to rise and shine. The Hebrews liked to rise and whine. We're just 3 days out of Egypt and they're already murmuring against God. And sadly, this will be an all too common occurrence over the next 40 years. Verse 25. So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters were made sweet. It was a tree that brought healing and brought purity. And guys, there is another tree that does the same. It's called the cross. The waters of life have also become poisoned. You know, even good things in life are no longer what they were intended to be. They no longer bring the joy that God intended without Jesus a part of it. But Jesus, when you put him into the mix, when you throw Jesus into the waters, boy, he makes bitter waters sweet. The cross heals even the bitter experiences of life by reminding us that Jesus loves us and that he feels what we feel and that he even uses suffering to accomplish his purposes and his plans and to work his miracles. We're told, there he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them and said, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians. Now with this tree that was tossed into the polluted waters, obviously, this was about God's healing. The intent behind this was his healing. You know, amoebas and dysentery were a common problem among Egyptian peasants and probably plagued the Hebrew slaves at this time. They had been living in Egypt for 400 years. Sap from the tree that God introduced into the mineral water may have pulled the minerals to the bottom of the pool so that the people could drink pure water on the surface. The water would still, though, have enough minerals in it to act as a laxative and sort of flush out their digestive tract. It's interesting to me that this whole episode may have been God's way of bringing healing to these people. Remember verse 15, chapter 15, verse 26, when we discuss God's laws later concerning diet and concerning hygiene. Remember what God says, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians. The regulations that God is going to impose on the Israelites are going to protect them from communicable disease and from food contamination. I've got a book in my library. It's by a medical doctor, a guy by the name of S.I. McMillan. It's entitled, None of These Diseases. And in it, he explains how that the laws of Moses were all health smart. It's interesting that Israel adopted standards and safeguards that Gentile nations didn't figure out for thousands of years. Dr. McMillan, he writes this, the biblical method for control of infectious skin diseases is unequaled in the history of ancient man. Historians credit the Bible for the dawning of a new era in the effective control of diseases. And so when later we get over to the different regulations in the law of Moses. Remember that God had a purpose behind those regulations. It was a way for wilderness people to fight back infection and fight back disease and to keep themselves healthy. In verse 26, God follows the healing of the waters with the revealing of a new name. We're told, for I am the Lord who heals you. What a wonderful name for God. The Lord who heals you. In the Hebrew, it's Jehovah Rapha, the Lord who heals. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees, a lot of dates. So they camped there by the waters. God flushes out their system, and then he brings them to a place where they can replenish themselves. The oasis of Elim could support a large contingency of people with ample food and water. Chapter 16. And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. This marks the 1 month anniversary of their exodus from Egypt. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against. Imagine that, they're complaining again. You're going to find these guys do nothing but grumble and complain for 40 years. They complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." What an ungrateful, unbelieving group of people. I mean, they've been free for a month now, and they're already unhappy. Be glad that Israel was not a democracy. They would have voted to return to Egypt, wouldn't they? This is why God governs his people through godly leaders, not through majority rule. Oftentimes, the majority's wrong. And notice here the three traits of complaining people. You might want to write these down. Here are the three traits of complaining people. Write them down. First thing they do is they rewrite history. Complaining people like to rewrite the past. They said while they were in Egypt, they sat by the pots of meat and they ate bread to the full. Now, wait a minute. When did the Egyptian slaves ever go to bed full? When did they ever sit by pots of meat? It was never as good as they claimed. Complainers tend to exaggerate the past. Second thing they did is they thought negative thoughts about the future. They rewrote history and then they thought negatively toward the future. God said he would bring them into a place of blessing, and now they're out there talking about starving in the desert. And then the third thing that complaining people do, they question the motivation of their leader. They question his motivation. Moses had risked his neck to stand up for these people before Pharaoh. He had behaved himself in an impeccable manner, and yet now here they are, they've ignored his track record, and they're claiming that it's his intention to kill them. Can you imagine these people? Verse 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you." In response to their grumbling, a gracious God promises them bread. And 6 days a week for the next 40 years, God will supernaturally provide for these people Wonder Bread. The original Wonder Bread. Each morning, he's going to rain down from heaven bread on his people. They'll exit their tents and they'll find these wafers on the ground, and God will cater them a meal every single day for the next 40 years. And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. Now the test came at gathering time. God said that they will gather a certain quota. In other words, a single day's portion. Now if their faith wavered, and if the people doubted God's faithfulness, and if they kept back extra loaves, you know, just in case God doesn't come through tomorrow. I mean, while we got it, why not get it? While it's here, why not store it up? But if they acted in that kind of an unbelieving way, the stash would rot. You know, it would literally rot. They would fail the test. They had to trust God only for what they needed for that day and that day alone. Verse 5 says, "And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily." On day 6, the Hebrews would collect for 2 days. This was the one exception. God will forbid work on the seventh day. It's the Sabbath day, and so on the sixth day, the people would gather a double portion. On that one day, it would not rot. God would sustain it for the next day. Then Moses and Aaron said to the children of Israel, "At evening, you shall know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt." God promised them bread in the morning, and he promises them a covey of quail in the evening. In the morning, they eat bread. At night, they eat meat. That's a pretty good deal. "And in the morning, you shall see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your complaints against the Lord. But what are we that you complain against us? Also, Moses said, this shall be seen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and in the morning bread to the full, for the Lord hears your complaints which you make against him. And what are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Lord. Isn't that interesting? The Hebrews had directed their complaints at Moses, but they were actually complaining against God and against God's will. I wonder how many times we complain about our pastor, or we complain about our boss, or we complain about our husband, or complain about our parents. And it's really not the authority over us we're complaining about. It's really the Lord, because the Lord is the one who's placed that person in authority over you. The Lord knows the situation. He knows, you know, what's happening. He's got you there for a reason, for a purpose. You think you're complaining about the situation or the person, but in reality, you're complaining about the Lord. Moses here was just a convenient scapegoat. God is sovereign over all situations. And so when we complain about the resources he provides, or the direction that he leads, or the situation that he allows, or the authority that he set over us, indeed, we are complaining about the Lord. It's been said, when we swear, we take the name of the Lord in vain, but when we grumble, we take the purposes of God in vain. Guys, it's a lot easier to complain than it is to believe. Murmuring and grumbling are really just masks for unbelief. Well, then Moses spoke to Aaron, "Say to all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your complaints." Now it came to pass, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And remember, God had provided Moses a navigation system. He was to follow a cloud in the daytime and a pillar of fire at night. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God." So it was that quails came up at evening and covered the camp. There are quails, a type of quail, that migrates from Europe to Arabia, and they actually cross the Sinai Peninsula. These are small birds. They have flat little heads, and they fly real close to the ground and roost in the bushes at night. They would have been easy prey for the Hebrews. Quail, interestingly, was an Egyptian delicacy. And so it's ironic here. God has the Hebrews eating better out in the desert than most Egyptians would have eaten in their own native land. And in the morning, the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance, kind of like a wafer, as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And in the Hebrew, the phrase, "What is it?" gets translated manna. Manna. The Hebrews called it manna, but remember, God always referred to it as bread from heaven. In fact, Psalm 78, verse 25, even refers to the substance as angels' food. I like to think of it as little angel food cake wafers all over the ground, man. How tasty. Whatever it was, I'm sure that if you had run chemical tests on it, you would have found that it contained 100% of the USDA daily nutritional requirements. It was the perfect food for desert life, and God was always on time with it, right on time. He never missed a meal.
The book of Exodus is aptly named because it describes the exodus of the Hebrew people from their enslavement in Egypt. This book is full of symbolism of our sin nature and the redemption we have in Jesus. It's our prayer that each day you join us as we study through Exodus, that you'll be drawn closer to Jesus. This has been another edition of Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. Sandy is the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, we're sure that today's message in Exodus has blessed and encouraged you in your walk with Jesus Christ. Maybe you'd like to review this message again, or perhaps a family member or friend has come to mind today. Visit sandyadams.org and click on the radio program option in the main menu. There you'll find today's message. All you need to remember is today's date, and visit sandyadams.org. Or give us a call right here at the church. Our phone number is 770-736-2828. That's 770-736-2828. Someone is standing by to talk with you. Again, just mention today's date and we'll send you the full-length CD. In the next edition, Pastor Sandy will continue taking us verse by verse through the book of Exodus. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, we want to say thank you for tuning in, and may God bless you.